In my hands, I'm wandering slowly to the promised land, and I tried to tell them why, but they couldn't understand I wake up in the morning, I'm feeling alright, but I can see your twisted faces in the morning light and a smile at the eyes of the fools who are counting up their jewels. Thinking of the wonderful things they could buy to multiply the stature of the little lies, and they try to put me down. The soles of my feet are brown. Yeah, well, I've got some pumpkin pie. I get a bite. Don't ask me why. I love a pumpkin pie. Makes me fly. Takes me to my sky. Don't ask me why. A wheel of a pumpkin pie. On the ground, fat cows, and shabami can hear my sound, and I try to let them see what it feels like to be free. Oh, no, no. Some faces come steaming by me, they be looking like a swarm of blue eyes flies, and I try to make them smile. I feel happy when they look me in the eye. Feel happy when they look me in the eye. Feel happy when they look me in the eye. And in the lines of my heart, I'll bite into the bumpers. I mean, they got no alive.
Welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show on TMS, oh no it's not, look at that, straight away, msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. I'm just having a quick speak to you because the whole thing's set up slightly differently from last time. So I'll have a quick look in the chat boxes and make sure that the music volume and voice volume is okay. If you could let me know, I'll play one more tune and then I'll be back with you. Stand from their latest recording at recorded at the St Giles Parish Church live, which got some beautiful songs on it. That has, they were playing at the Fire in the Mountain Festival where I've spent the last week or so crewing and taking photographs and doing interviews and scavenging CDs and even doing a bit of recording of music on the voice recorder, which has come out reasonably well as it happens. And that's what I want to concentrate on tonight's show, really. It's the second anniversary of the Dr. Rock Show. I think the first show went out on June the 9th in 2011. And that is time that has really, really rushed by. I've got some new technology now, which appears to be working very well, hence the slightly different setup that I've got. I've got finally got myself a mobile hotspot, Wi-Fi hotspot, which seems to work nearly everywhere. The only place it hasn't worked so far was at the Fire in the Mountain Festival, where I was hoping to do a bit of live broadcasting from the field in the mornings, but there was no signal there anyway, which was a bit of a pain for the broadcasting, but it was really good because it kept everybody off their mobile phones. So I guess I'd like to say a big hi to the people from 3 in Aberystwyth to start with, because it was a pretty complicated job making everything work. I think I'd have had a lot of difficulty if I'd just got it off the internet and run with it. But after a quick visit and everything and plugging it all in, it's been really great. So I can upload and download as much stuff as I like. I've got a much stronger and faster signal than I've ever had before. And I think it really is going to make my life a lot easier, together with the new voice recorder, which also seems to work pretty well. So really, from here on in, I am going to be able to broadcast from anywhere that there's a signal. And that's going to make things a lot more lively. Hopefully we'll return a little bit more to the way the show was when it first started. As time's gone by, the show has kind of developed its own kind of musical taste, really, because I've been out listening to bands and dancing to them and what have you, and deliberately trying to spot things that are going to be attractive to all you good people out there. It means that rather than just the straight hard rock, which is what I used to listen to nearly all the time, I have really developed my interest in bluegrass and country rock, I guess you'd call it. And also, as people will have noticed if they've been listening for the last couple of years, I really like the young and stroppy ska bands that are coming up as well. So kicking bluegrass, hard rock and ska has become pretty much the signature of the show. But tonight, almost every single track we're going to hear are going to be from bands that played at the Fire in the Mountain. So it's a chance to look at the folksy bluegrass end of the Doctor's medicine chest. It ranges really from the wild and utterly kicking to the extremely quiet and beautiful. There were a lot of outstanding musicians at the festival, as we'll hear, not only the people that played on the main stage, but especially the members of the crew, who themselves, some may remember from last year, playing several bands. And they work really hard, running from stage to stage and playing with almost anybody. In addition, this year, it was a nearly sellout year. And there were scratch bands everywhere, so everywhere you wandered around there'd be maybe 12 or 14 people, some of whom were playing instruments I'd never seen before, and they were just all of them kicking out really amazing chicken kicking music. You went down to the woods, you'd maybe come across a lady with a cello just playing to a really beautiful, peaceful, open space with the birds singing and a stream running by her. I've done my best to get the interviews in places where there's plenty of that kind of background noise. That again was characteristic of the early shows, which came from places like the Out of the Ordinary Festival and the Green Gathering and the Off Grid. And there'll be a chance for me, hopefully, as I talk my way through what was really, I think, one of the finest weekends I've ever had. It'll give me a chance to remember some of the other fine weekends and hopefully to give you a genuine insight into what was the most peaceful and beautiful place it's ever been my privilege to spend a week or so. We kind of got there on the Tuesday when it was absolutely lashing it down. I really couldn't believe it. We got all of our waterproofs absolutely soaking, just getting the tent up. The tent itself is really old and manky, and as a result, two or three bits of it tore off in the process of putting it up, which in the rain was looking really dodgy. But as is the way of things, there just happened to be an individual walking by who could see the state I was in, dripping water, desperate for beer, and with a tent, which if I couldn't do something with it, then both me and Synchro, otherwise known as Jess, were going to get very wet, and so would our bedding. But he reminded me of an old trick which involved just picking up two or three pebbles and some bits of string, and we mackled it all together, and the tent stood up brilliantly to that night of foul weather. Wednesday dawned fine, and we had no rain and all sunshine for the whole weekend. Itself completely exceptional. I'm not sure it makes up for 10 years of getting pissed on at Welsh festivals, but it certainly did make a difference. People, as I've observed before, really come out of themselves when the sun is shining. You can see how much difference the sun makes to us in that kind of condition. when people are cold and shivering and trying to fight off the damp, they're less likely to communicate and smile and the rest. But the sunshine really turned on 1,000 people to appreciate all the work that had been done to turn this thing out. I really hope that you enjoy listening to all of this as much as I've enjoyed putting it together. The podcast from this week's show will include all of the music as well, because we got permission to leave all of it in from all of the people that played it, and hopefully it will become a tribute to the festival and to the organisers and to everything that went on. Full credit really to all of those who entertained us for those 3 bright and sunny days. And so I'm going to try and include proper commendation to all of the people that we play, because that means that if, as and when people download the podcast, they will know and they will be able to follow these guys up. Some of them are also on tour, and I'll be trying to give details of the tour dates and where they're going as well. Just exactly whether I'll be able to keep track of all of this stuff is, of course, anybody's guess. There is also a slideshow at the msiradio.com chat box site. There's a live chat box there for anybody who's tuning in for the first time, and I'm not sure whether you have to kind of actually sign up to see the slideshow that's just in the schedule just underneath the chat box there. And we might as well go to that straight away and look at the first few photos before listening to an interview I had with a lady called Katie, who was responsible for doing a couple of opening ceremonies in the healing area that we had at the festival. Festival's a big site, really, very well spaced out. There's plenty of room for everybody, so it kind of felt much more like a big party than anything else. Actually, before I do that, I shall just click over to here and let you know what all of that music was. The 2-minute kicking tune with an audience that we listened to start with was Sheila Nagig, who played a really, really blinding set. That one was recorded on the voice recorder, actually in the barnyard, and so it is a bit rough. I have, in fact, managed to arrange to get all of the recordings from the main stage as they're mixed down, so that over the next few months, hopefully, I'll be able to bring you a little bit of everybody that played there. We will end up with a full set, hopefully, of the various jams and the official bands that played, including Sheila Nagig. I followed Sheila Nagig with Kidnap Alice and Chilly Winds, a song that will be familiar to you all. Great news is that Kidnap Alice have come up with a new EP, which I've been hassling them for really a couple of years. It's got some beautiful songs on it, one of which has particularly individual memories for Dr. Rock and my relationship with the band. One of the songs apparently has got an invalid name for the broadcaster. I shall try and fix that whilst one of the podcasts is being played. The next tune we heard, the slightly more irregular and musical one that went from a very slow and beautiful violin up to the thoroughly kicking, was the John Langan Band, and it was a tune called Pumpkin Pie. They headlined, I believe, the Sunday night, and I got to spend a fair bit of time round a fire with John Langan, who is a really fantastic young Scottish man, and evidently, in my opinion, one hell of a songwriter. That's one of the things that will perhaps be a bit more apparent in this show, shall we say, than some of the others, is the quality of the musicianship and songwriting. The most recent song we heard, as I said, was Heal the Last Stand. It was called The Gathering, and the first time I saw Heal the Last Stand was at the second Truth Juice Gathering, where they played a truly beautiful set. I have got a pair of their CDs and have indeed played a couple of their tunes in the past. They generally are too gentle and don't have enough pace for Dr. Rock, but tonight we'll be hearing 2 or 3 songs from them. The other thing is, I think that because they were recorded live in that church, you've got a fantastic ambience to the recording, and it means that the stuff that's so often lost on the way through the studio is very much there on that particular recording. As I go through, I shall also try and post in various links to these people's websites so that you can go and have a look and see what they look like and what they're doing. But if we now, let's try and get rid of that and that, and see if we can't move down to the slideshow a little bit. It's called Dr. Rock's Radio Show, Sights and Sounds from the Fire in the Mountain Festival 2013. Tan yn y Mynydd is the Welsh for Fire in the Mountain, and I've called it fire in the mountain, fire in the heart. And that phrase almost brings tears to my eyes, actually, because that is really just so much how I feel about the weekend. And I hope some of that feeling is going to be brought across to you in this show. The first slide, and I seem to remember there being a little difficulty with the slide numbering last time I did this. So what I've done is I've actually, with the title of the slide, I put a number against it. And I'm going to call this slide 1, because it says 1 on it, and then it says healing area approach, hopefully, if you've got the right slide up in front of you. It gives you some idea of the area in which this festival was occurring. We were at an ancient farmhouse where Kidnap Alice, the band, have a bit of a relationship with the lady that has title to the land, and the festival is spread extremely well over the whole site. This particular place where the healing area is down a muddy track, which did in fact more or less dry out this year, more than could be said for last year. And what we're looking at is a small collection of yurts and tents in which a group of dedicated healers, kinesiologists, shiatsu practitioners, tarot readers, and various other people were making themselves available to help people out as they came down. And I know that actually the place was pretty much booked out, I think, by the Sunday morning. So perhaps next year we'll have to have more of them. But in there, there's a beautiful kind of shelter where people can sit whilst they're waiting for things to happen. There's a couple of small yurts in there, one slightly bigger than the other, which you can't see both of them from there. They were one of my responsibilities. Me and Jess, or Synchro, we're yurt fairies officially at this festival. Obviously, we do other things as well, but one of our main jobs is to help put up the yurts and then take them down again afterwards and to make sure they're running properly. The one that was our main concern was the workshop yurt, known as the Trad Academy, of which we'll hear a little bit more later on. So that's a view there of the approach to the healing area. There's a little wooden bridge that was made to get across what was, again, slightly muddy patch, but all the muddy patches dried up. If you go to the second slide, which is called Healing Area Shelter, you can see in the middle of the picture there a fairly vague photograph of Diana, or Diney as she's known. She was the core member of the crew that was responsible for this particular area. And one of the lessons that the people had learnt from last year was that the key crew, I think, should be given much more responsibility for their particular area, and that they should be enabled to concentrate on all of the details necessary to make that particular area run properly. So I know that Diney had a much bigger crew to help her this year, and she was basically given license to do whatever she needed to do to make this work. The same thing was true of the bar and the music and the ticketing and the front of house. That meant that everything ran a lot more smoothly than it did last year, which was only the second year of the festival. It meant things were a lot more beautiful and a lot more easy to access. I think it did also mean that those core members of the crew did get absolutely shattered by the end of the festival, because they were kind of linchpins. Very, very difficult for them to actually take any time off without things starting to run a little less smoothly, perhaps. Maybe next year there'll be room for some seconds in command, as it were, in those places. But I think the size of the crew probably really, well, hopefully we managed to help all us odd bods that were around, managed to help these main key characters do what they needed to do. At the front of the picture, which you can't quite see, there's a lovely little table, which we made out of some scrap bits of wood that we found. We made a lot of stuff, actually, out of bits and bobs. And it's got on it a fantastic selection of Organite. I was hoping to put a better photo of that up, but I didn't have one. Made by a guy called Jez, who was one of the first people we met. He was part of the healing area crew, and he was just a really lovely guy and kind of set the tone, really, for the whole thing, that very first meeting. I really love it when the people I come across, I just know on a first meeting that you've got a new friend, you've got somebody you can trust and with whom you're going to get on. And indeed we did. We got on very well with Jez throughout the festival. And just behind Diana there is the bigger of her two yurts. I can't quite remember how big it was. 16, 18 foot across, I think. And then she had a smaller one as well. You can see that the place is in a really nice woodland glade. The next area, the next healing area shot shows a view down the stream. And effectively all those little tents are kind of held in the elbow, as it were, of a quiet stream that runs right the way through this part of the site. It meant that everybody who was taking any sort of healing or consultation or whatever in those tents could all hear the sound of running water, which is very helpful. It is said that the sound of water running from one side of you to the other affects your subconscious in such a way that it helps things, helps you release things, helps things that you're trying to move on. And it's what a lot of the massage does, is it moves energies about the body and pulls things out of you that you don't really need there anymore. In the blue cardigan there, sitting quietly on the banks of the stream, is the lovely Dolly May, who's the lady who's responsible really for all the front of house and for managing the, I keep wanting to call them hostages, what they're called, stewards, that's the word. I've got a bit of a mental block there. She arranged for the wristbands and was on the go for all 3 days of the festival, making sure that it all clicked into place. Again, Dolly seemed a lot more relaxed than last year, but as I think one of my interviewees says, really, it's having a sound head of operations is what really ensures that your thing works properly. And Dolly is really very good at that job. She's also a member of a band called Santa Mozzarella, who I recorded live in the Owl's World music stage that we had there. But unfortunately, I've forgotten to move that particular piece across, which is a bit of a shame, because recorded as it was on the voice recorder, it catches the absolute mayhem of the audience at some of these gigs. The extraordinary exuberance and enthusiasm and support for all of the bands that were on. And one of the ones that got the biggest response in there was definitely Santa Mozzarella. So perhaps you'll have to wait till next week for that particular treat. And there you go. That's a view upstream as we look downstream from there, which we don't have a photograph of. The stream runs off into woodland, and the little elbow on which all of the healing yurts and tents stand is not only kind of held carefully in the elbow of that stream, but it's also surrounded by a grove of old oak trees. I think there were 8 or 10 of them all together, and they did make a circle around the whole thing. And I don't know how many of you get a chance to come and spend some time in your genuine Welsh woodland down in the river and stream valleys, but they are extremely beautiful and peaceful places. Sometimes you get to see like a mountain ash tree that's growing out of the heart of an old oak tree. You get to see rocks that are covered in moss, and you get to see the roots from trees and weeds and grass washing in water that is simply running down a path it's made for itself amongst all the tree roots. The trees have often got ferns growing in their boughs as well. And there's also a lot of lichen, an entirely different form of life from the rest of us and the plant world, which in places like this grows really tall and long and shaggy and doesn't have to cling to the branches at all. Absolutely gorgeous places, and this was a particularly lovely place. It's great as well to be able to see the place when you finally get to the end of the festival and everything's taken down and moved away again, to just be able to sit in these beautiful places and feel all of the work that's been done there and the peace of the place afterwards. In the foreground of the healing area view shot is a set of white stones that were collected from around the place by children and volunteers and laid out, as you'll see in the next shot, which isn't too brilliant, but it does catch the general essence. The healing area stones, there's a lot of quartz there. That's what it is, quartz with a little bit of granite in it. And we know that the ancients who built all of our megalithic sites and the rest like to work with stones that have got a high crystal content. Crystal is one of the most coherent things we have on the planet. Our own blood and lymph system is crystalline in structure, as are our own neocortexes. They've got little sacks of liquid crystal in them that are extremely responsive to light and to other energetic vibrations. And so this little crystal circle was made. There's an opening in it so that the pixies and the elementals and whatever else who wants to get in and out can. There's an old tree stump there, which if I'd had a better camera, this was done on the new phone hotspot as well. I'm still getting used to it. But there's a really beautiful little, old rotten tree that is covered in all sorts of lichen and moss and a little bunch of flowers there as well. In the foreground, there's what looks like a little folded package, which is exactly what it is. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. It's called a dispaccio, and it's an idea, I think, that comes from Peru and played a central part in one of the ceremonies that I was talking about with Katie. I think that's the end of the healing area slide. So we got to slide 4 on that. And what I will do on that note, I think, is probably move on to the interview or the discussion, the little chat that I had with Katie. It was one of the first things we did, I think probably just before the festival opened, or maybe at its opening time. The two things we really wanted to do were to open up the whole space, this kind of oak grove and stream. We wanted to open it up so that the people could do the work that they wanted to do in it. Now, when you get to these places, especially I feel a special kindred to the stream valleys and wooded slopes of the lower parts of Wales. And it can be really hard when you're in a city, especially I notice when you're in somewhere like London, where there's a lot of buses and a lot of sirens and a lot of people. You're actually sharing your energetic space with people who are outside your dwelling and moving about on the street. And I find that it can be really quite hard to enter any kind of meditative state, to actually calm the beating of the heart and all the rest of it, and to become silent inside. I find it a lot easier now than I used to, and in fact in cities I used to find it more or less impossible. However, even before I started practicing meditation and yoga and the like myself, I did find these places in Wales peaceful, to the point where the inside of me started just to reflect the outside, sitting by with my back to a tree, watching a stream going by and listening to the birds in the trees, was in itself enough to just kind of quiet everything down. There almost wasn't any need or any effort necessary to do any work. It just kind of seeps into you. And Katie and I talk a lot about sacred space, and I think that's what we mean. These places are to a great extent sacred. They haven't been built on. They're left to all the spiders and butterflies and all the other beasties that wander around in them on a regular basis. And we believe that the place is also full of energetic beings that we perhaps can't see but kind of know are there. The other thing about sacred space is it's something that the word sacred's very hard, I think. I like to think of it myself as if something's sacred, it's at the heart of things, and it is unchanging. Much of our sacred knowledge has remained unchanged since it was first written down, which is why I refer to the geometry I talk about as sacred geometry, because it was first written down 350 years before Christ, I guess, and that basic information has not changed since it was written down, and it was known for a long time before anybody committed it to paper. We might have learned a lot more about it, and we might have learned more about how it's applicable, but the matter of the thing itself, the actual geometry and the shapes, have not changed. And to a great extent, you can feel these ancient places. There's been humans in them maybe for thousands of years, but the space has remained greatly, largely untouched. And so they have a kind of feel of sacredness to them when we get there. One of the reasons I think we do the ceremonies to open them up is to try and ensure that feeling of sacredness, that the actual vibration of the place, the feeling of it, is not changed by all of the activity that goes in it, so that it becomes perhaps more distracting. I think it was an absolutely beautiful place to establish a healing area. Last year, the healing area was much, much further downstream in a fairly wild and woolly area that you had to cross a bog and several other things to get there. It meant a lot more carrying and stuff. It also made it more difficult for people to find it and to get there. This year, I think it was popular not only because it was closer, but because it was a considerably more beautiful and accessible space generally. The two ceremonies that I talk about with Katie, as many of you will know, I became interested in ceremony many years ago now, largely as a result of my interactions with the Mayan calendar. And since then, ceremony has entered my life through the use of geometry and various other means, and I find myself doing a lot more of it. One of the hats that I wear when I'm out and about at these things is I have a very sweet rucksack that I carry around that was given to me by my nephew, and it's in the shape of Yoda from Star Wars, and it looks very realistic. He's got his little claws over my shoulders as you wear the rucksack, and his head's slightly to one side, so he peers out from my left ear, as it were, and makes me look a little bit like Zaphod Beeblebrox. But inside that is a whole mass of incense that I have gathered over the years from various places. People brought me a load back from Mexico. I've got some very nice smelling stuff called dragon's blood that does look like boiling blood when you put it on the charcoal. We've got standard religious incense. We've got incense that looks a little bit like weed. There's a whole load of stuff in there. There is even an incense that has been named after me and was made for me. And one of the things I do at these ceremonies is I make sure that there is particularly beautiful incense burnt. This time round I used a copal incense, which came from Chiapas in the Maya lands, and it is extremely sweet and beautiful smell. I find, without exception, that people who have not come across it before are sort of elevated, lifted, just by breathing the stuff in. And of course, that's the idea. The idea is to lift people's spirits. In this case, these particular incenses from the Maya lands are also particularly effective because they are used to call in the ancestors for ceremony. And I'm not sure it's always clear to people that we are not only ourselves, that we are the, if you like, the focal point of our entire ancestral line as we stand in this present day, that all of the things that have come before have led to what we are and what we think, to the shape of our bodies, to the way we use them, to what we choose to use with the bodies. And we are the focal point through which what happens in the future will be expressed. So, in a very real sense, time is a bit of an illusion, and we are merely on the path of our descendants or ascendants, whatever we want to call them, and to address them with incense or the brains of heaven, to actually bring them close to our own space, to call them to mind, for all the use that they have been to us in the past is helpful. And two ceremonies that I'm talking about with Katie, one of them is a medicine wheel ceremony in which we call in the energies of the seven directions. And the second one we talk about, that was the one that we did standing outside in the oak grove by the main healing yurt. And then we moved into the yurt for the second ceremony, where Katie made a thing called a dispatchio, which I haven't come across before. She talks about it a little bit. One of the phrases I think that might be unfamiliar to people is that she talks about blowing in ideas. And what she'd done was she'd brought in a lot of things from nature, which were described to a certain extent in the interview. And the idea was that I think there were sort of 14, 15, maybe 16 people at this ceremony, was that we each took parts of this stuff at various parts of the ceremony, and what we were bringing to mind were our hopes and aspirations for the festival, for the healing area, and for the people who were coming there. There was a lot of loving kindness in it, and what you do is you blow, you think about these things, hold them in your mind, and then blow them into the into the various items that are being used to make the dispaccio. So that's what she means when she's talking about blowing in. Sacred space is the space that we were in anyway, and it's simply a matter of using ceremony and attention and well-chosen words to ensure that that's the way it stays for the duration of our time there. So this first interview is with Katie. There's a little lad's voice that pops up every now and then in this. I haven't had time to edit all of these things the way I might have liked to, but at the same time, I think that whatever occurs, is supposed to be part of it. And unfortunately, whilst he got my name out of me, I didn't get his name out of him. Isn't that brilliant? What a smart and wily wee lad he is. But you can hear him in the background. And another background noise that occurs during this is, at this particular festival, there was a lot more activity for children. The children last year, I think, found it a bit of a trial, partly because of the weather and partly because there wasn't anything particularly aimed at them. This time we did have a children's area. They had their own cafe, which apparently had beans on toast for sale in it, and nobody told me that, else I would have gone there and visited it myself. But another thing that was done, which works really well for children at these events, is the idea was put forward that we should have a bit of a procession. And that for the procession, there would be some songs learnt and some drumming learnt, and there'd be costumes made and the like. And if you'd like to just revisit the slideshow for a minute, the slide that's labelled slide 5 has the words Mary Lloyd on it. It's a pretty vague picture because I took it at night and haven't mastered the flash, which I can see is on the camera, but I haven't managed to work out how it works. My somewhat stubby fingers are finding it a bit hard to manipulate. What it is a shroud. It's a white shroud with ribbons and the like on it, and on top of, and it's got a stick up inside the shroud. And on top of it is a horse's head. It's the skeleton of a horse's head, and it's possible to move the jaw on that. Apparently this is an ancient Welsh, pastime isn't the word, but it's one of those things that happens every year. It normally happens at New Year properly, but here they decided to do it at the festival. And the idea is that this character goes round and knocks on the doors of all the houses in a village. And the main job, and what it's doing at the start of the day, is it's speaking poetry. And the main job of the householder, of the people in the dwelling, is to make sure that this skeletal horse figure does not get into the house. And once the Mary Lloyd is convinced to turn from the house door, it moves on to the next house and it starts hassling them, and the people from the first house follow it. And the idea is that by the end of the day, everybody in the village is following this thing, and I'm sure there will be the usual a bacchanalia and drinking and partying at the end. And during as well, by the sound of it, because by the end of the day, this horse figure is getting very ribald, and it tells a lot of smutty and dirty jokes, and it becomes more and more filthy in its habits. And I can't help feeling that all of that would be a really great way of getting a village to get out and kind of talk to itself and meet all the people around the place. And there's something really lovely and ancient about the whole thing. The reason why it's relevant to this particular interview is because this procession, as it turns out, happens whilst Katie and I are talking. We're sitting in the healing area, so you'll probably be able to hear in the background the stream running by us. You'll certainly be able to hear some of the birds singing in the trees. They're not too noisy at that time of the day. But also, the Mary Lloyd comes down with all the children and the drums and the singing. And it moves right past us and then down the stream, where it goes and visits the showers, which we've got some pictures of later on, and our sauna. We had a sort of fire-powered steam sauna built over the river, which we'll also be looking at. And then the Mary Lloyd came all the way back from there over a bridge, which was to our right, and ended up behind us, actually in the centre of the healing area. It doesn't at any point actually drown out the speaking, though it can make it a little harder to concentrate, but because it's always on the move, none of it lasts too long. So here we go. Here's half an hour or so of me having a chat with Katie about ceremony, about the seven directions, and about the dispaccio. Her training, I think, is, I believe, from Peru. We had several really beautiful shaman-type ladies there who seem to have a really gentle way with words and a really gentle way with people and with the world in which they find themselves. So here she is. Half an hour at last. There's half an hour of recorded interview that I've managed to get together. And hopefully this is the start of another load of shows where I'll find many more people to talk to. So here you go, folks. I'll come and join you in the chat box whilst this is happening. I'll have a bit more music and a bit of comment afterwards. There's plenty of show tonight. I shall, I think, by way of celebrating these 2 years of fun and frolic with the technology at first TNS and now MSI, by trying to go all the way through from my 6 o'clock opening to midnight, because I know that Jack's taking a bit of a break at the moment, Freeman Jack. And probably from next week, it seems that I'll be having a go at the 9 till midnight slot. So we'll no longer have to get this really early crack on as I come in from the gardens. I should hopefully be, pretty relaxed and not asleep by 9 o'clock at night. But tonight we're going to try and do the whole thing. Thanks, of course, to all of you for being there. Here's me and Kate.
So they got invited back this year,
yeah. Yeah, well, they're just ideal, really, for this kind of show. So I'll just put that like that. And if I put that over the top of it, that should keep the wind off it, and I'm pretty sure that'll be able to hear us, and it'll separate us into left and right quite nicely. So I'm sitting... It is going to be one.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
Yeah.
I know your name.
Do you?
Is it not that?
Yeah, I don't know your name. Ah, there you go. So I'm sitting in the healing area with Kate, who's been working really hard out in the woods with people. If you prefer Kate or Katie?
I usually get called Katie, but some people call me Kate, and that sounds...
Okay, well, either will do that, I guess.
Yeah, Peter
Creaney,
that's right.
And first time I met you, you were doing the facilitating the opening ceremonies for the healing area, and I've been interested in ceremony for a long time. Why do you think it's important for us to do that sort of thing at the beginning?
It's useful just to hold the sacred space, just to hold us in a space where we can work.
Yeah.
Connecting with the energies around us, the elemental energies, and giving us focus as well, and intention, and bringing us together. And it does feel, especially with the healing fields, to be held in that sacred space just helps hold us as we work.
Yeah.
Especially working with healing therapies. We're working with a lot of people coming in with issues and situations. So to be held and be able to hold people as they release their issues and situations is really useful. And it's nice to do that over festivals. I've done it over whole festivals as well. And it can increase synchronicity, and it can increase the feeling of sacred time.
Yeah. And it's, I presume, a way of sort of attuning, because we're made of the elements that we're sitting amongst. So it's a way of attuning us and our energy fields to the energy that we're working with and in.
Yeah, exactly. And it's inviting energies in, as represented by serpent, jaguar, eagle, and hummingbird, and inviting in the lineage. Mm. And what these represent, we don't take them literally. Is the serpent represents the binding principle, and the releasing of our past, the way the serpent shed their skin. Jaguar represents the emotions and the mind, and also giving back to the earth that which no longer serves us. It's inviting in these energies to hold us. Some traditions invite in earth, air, water, wind to represent these energies.
Yeah.
They say science invites in electromagnetism, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, receptive principle, dynamic principle.
So those are like modern words for the spirits of place that were experienced by our ancestors, who had different words for them.
These energies, just a way to describe these energies, and it's bringing them in. But exactly like you said, it's they're in us as well, and it's feeling that connection.
Yeah,
it's the merging between the nature, these energies, and the energies that we have like that in ourselves as well, I think straight away.
Yeah, perhaps we could talk a little bit about the directions, because the ceremony that you did to open the area with started off with greetings to the directions, didn't it? Perhaps because that's a good way of talking about these different energies and influences so that people can remember them, perhaps.
It is.
So could you talk us through just a bit about each of the directions you did?
Okay, so...
You started with the south,
with
didn't
the south. We? Yeah, we start with the south. And when we do our medicine wheel training, our journey of the four winds, that's a basic map of which an initiate or a trainee goes through the path and learns their journey, learns their craft. And the actual calling in the directions actually relates to that as well. It relates to that journey. So we start off in the south. In the south class, the training we do, we find our stories and we shed our stories. And it is like the serpent can shed a skin. The serpent doesn't hold on to the skin all the time, it sheds it. So it keeps shedding the past.
Yeah.
And the more you shed the past, the more you can bring in you what you know what you do choose.
So the serpent's associated with the south and the beginning of the journey.
And we ask the serpent, can you hold your sacred space? And we call it the binding principle, because the serpent binds everything together and then pulls it off, releases it, the skin comes off in one piece. So we're asking the serpent to, you know, can we continue to shed our stories the way you shed your skin so sweetly. So rather than holding on to the stories, being able to just keep releasing them, because we don't need to hold on to them.
It's an interesting point, that, isn't it? Because a lot of people do hold on to their stories. They have an experience which might be to their disadvantage or for their greater learning, and then instead of letting it go and letting it flow behind them, they just tell the story again and again and again, so embedding it not only in their own self but in the selves of others around them.
Yeah.
So this is what we're talking about here, is a principle that works on experiencing something, then moving on and not impressing it on the lives of loads of others.
Exactly, because the more you embed it, the more you're attracting it, so you keep getting the same story coming and complaining that the same thing keeps happening. But we can release those stories. We can even, you know, these stories might have given us valuable gifts, and if so, that's great. Get the gift.
Yeah.
Release the stories, you can keep the gift and release the stories.
I know the Mayan cycles work like that as well, from initiation at one up to the number 11, which is liberation and release. And it is to do with all the stuff that you take on board, all the positive stuff that's happened in the 9 or 10 days leading up to it, and then let go of the stuff you don't need, which is followed by kind of a day of cooperation and transmission before you go back to the beginning of another cycle.
It's useful with energy in general, you know. So imagine if that river over there, if that decided to dam up and just hold this water in this one space, wouldn't let any of it through, it would just go stagnant, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So the more we can release, the more the water can flow, the more the energy can keep flowing. And the more you let go, the more energy comes in.
Yeah.
Like that stream, the more it's letting go of water,
it's like space, isn't it, as well? If you kind of keep space clear, there's room to put more important stuff when it arrives.
Yeah. And we don't need to hold on to these things. They're there in the past. If we really want to access them, we can, you know, access, like, you know, our past if we really want to, in the history books or whatever. But, you know, we don't need to hold on to it. We can, you know, somewhere deep in our memories, if we really want to find them, we can find them. But we don't need to just keep releasing them.
And so after the south, we went to the west.
Yeah, place the jaguar. And jaguar's the symbol of the west, because he emerges in the jungle, the forest, and helps mulch and McCree and give back to the earth, which no longer serves us. So it's just like we give food compost back to the earth, and the earth just creates beautiful trees and plants with it. It's that kind of like giving back to the earth and mulching it, bringing it back into earth and just letting it go. It's also often the medicine wheel journey, as well as the releasing of ancestric and karmic ties. So in the south, we've released stories which no longer serve us, but we're also releasing our parents' stories that have been passed down to us, our parents' parents' stories that have been passed down to us. And also, if past lives are exist, which experience that shows there's something, there seems to be something in it. Experiences from previous lives we've led, whether that's, you know, whether that's in our DNA or whether it's in our energy field, as it seems to be, that can affect now as well. So it's also working, tracking back through time for that and clearing those so they're not affecting us, and working with the ancestors and clearing their effects on us.
It is interesting that as well, isn't it? Because I know it's said in this culture, not so much in the shamanic cultures, but in this culture it's said that we're actually living the lives of our grandparents, because that it's the kind of moral code from two generations ago that's being kind of passed down the line. Mm-hmm. And that none of, because of the nature of the culture, nobody gets any teaching or any help in the raising and the having of children.
Mm.
And so in a way, those patterns are kind of imprinted on nearly all of us. And again, this kind of ceremony can help us to at least start thinking about moving from that into the world we're living in, rather than, and you think about them, our grandparents and parents went through the First World War and the Second World War, and we haven't had conscription, none of our young men have been forced to go and fight and things, so there is a new world for us to be into.
Yeah, and you know, and you can understand, you know, of course in the training you go into more depth with it, and the opening sacred space is just, you know, asking for us to, you know, like I said, begin to be able to do that, and to be able to do that. But and there's various techniques to working with the ancestors, and you see almost it was personified, and you can see why they want to affect future generations. If, you know, they've got their reason why they've passed down these patterns to us. But again, it's more beneficial for them to be released. Again, you know, it's like thank you for the gift that you've given us, but you know, release our hold now. We want to make a new. It's time for us to make a new.
Yeah, keep hold of the core and again, release the unnecessary stuff.
Or just hear the gifts, what their gifts are, and then they can let go. And it's important for us to do so, if we can, because it affects our children. It can affect our children and children's children. Also, like I've experienced, and so I've been seeing.
Yeah.
When working with the work.
And then comes the north.
It is.
Yeah.
This is a place we call in the hummingbird. They used to call in the dragon as well, or rather in place, but for some reason it's evolved into the hummingbird. But both work, because they're both creatures. Well, the dragon works because it's a place of the mythic. And the hummingbird works because it's also the place of the journeyer. And how the hummingbird just trusts in the calling. It travels hundreds of miles, not worrying where it's going to taste, where it's going to get its food from. It just trusts in its journey. It hears its calling. It just goes. It goes on its adventure and trusts that there'll be food along the way, and it finds it. You know, yeah. Well, was it from North to South America it travels? It's really vast distances for this little tiny bird. Mm. So hummingbird's got... represents, you know, what's to teach us is about hearing our calling, and you know, sensing our adventure and going on our adventure with that trust and tasting the sweet nectar that's in our lives. That's what we ask, you know, can we do that? And it also sometimes reminds me of remembering not to take life too seriously sometimes, that it is you know, it is something to enjoy, and it is like a grand adventure, and it's seeing like our everyday stories as the mythic story, the fairy tale, the hero's journey, these wonderful archetypical journeys that we go on, and it's quite useful to see it from that perspective. And it can just change from being bogged down into a story like, oh, poor me, it's like, oh, actually this is quite a journey of transformational learning.
Yeah.
So it's quite useful.
Because in that kind of context, I mean, people tend to assume that we only get support by events and people supporting us, but actually we get at least half our support through challenge and through people who...
I prefer to learn with ease and grace, as they call it.
Yes, yeah.
But if it is something is challenging... Mm. There often is, if not, at least often.
I know that some of the what appeared in my life to be the biggest betrayals, and they've been quite minor really, but they were, at the time, they looked really major. They looked like really major betrayals. And very quickly afterwards, it became apparent that had that not occurred, there was a whole load of opportunities I wouldn't have been able to take. And it did turn out to be absolute. All three of them turned out to be absolutely what needed to happen. And it also, the hummingbird story reminds me of Joseph Campbell's advice to his students. He's a sort of master of myth. Yeah. He wrote Hero with a Thousand Faces. Yeah. And he said that he basically gives the same advice when asked, which is follow your bliss. Wow. Because doors will open to you that would not open otherwise. And he said, in fact, doors will open for you that just wouldn't be there for other people.
Aww. Yeah, exactly. And I think Homebird is a place of the mythic, isn't it? Do a symbol.
Yeah. Yeah, and once you start realizing it, synchronicity does reveal a bit more of itself, doesn't it? If you start following that path with it, sincerity and confidence and excitement.
Yeah, follow your bliss. I wish I'd learned that many years ago. I could have done with learning that many years ago.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to discover it now. You know, at least I've discovered it now. I might have gone my whole life without discovering that, to follow my heart. And
yeah. Again, I think the Maya have a line on that because they see things happening in 13-year cycles. So there's a major change at 13, which we recognise because you become what's now called a teenager. At 26, sort of close to 30, there's another one at 39, life begins at 40, and then there's one at 52. When you've completed your physical development then and you begin 52 years of spiritual development. And I know many people now, and I'm 52 this year, and I, especially here, I've really felt the difference, you know, of all of those years' experience and all the different places I've been to. And I always like to see the bearded old gits at the festival sitting around chatting, and now I am one. You know, it's been brilliant to talk to all these people, but you have to have the 52 years, you know.
I think.
Some people may be just born with it, but the thing is that once you've lived 52 years, you've lived through what the Maya call a bundle of years. Mm-hmm. So you live through the whole interrelation of their 260-day sacred calendar. Mm-hmm. Has intermeshed completely with the 365-day calendar. Mm-hmm. It takes 52 years to live through all those possibilities.
Done.
So...
Yeah, it's interesting. I have to experiment and let you know.
Yeah, yeah.
See what the differences are. But, you know, then again, you know, people are experiencing spiritual development at so many different ages.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose children are naturally born with it, in a way. But what I'm enjoying is so much wisdom coming. Might have been passed down to generations, but I'm finding more and more people coming to it through themselves as
yes,
well.
Yes, just finding it rising within.
Yeah. And if it is likely to be true, then I guess people are going to find it themselves, and I'm loving that. And and in the north is where we normally also do invite in our ancestors of the healing lineage to come and help hold the sacred space as well, and we thank them for sharing the wisdom that they've passed down to us.
So is the north associated with the ancestors in your journey?
It is generally, yeah.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. The place of the north where they go. It's also the place of the mountains, the Apus. And they say when we leave, the wisdom is stored in the mountains.
Oh, and the bones of the earth.
Yeah, and in our journey, when we come around the medicine wheel, the north is starting to step into our journey and also learning to connect with nature and learning from nature and, you know, and ourselves, sourcing from the wisdom within and from nature at a very deep level. So after releasing the past stories, releasing these karmic and seshic ties, it's starting to come and learning, you know, lots of other people's experiences and processes, starting to come into your own and just learning from nature itself. And then in the north, in the medicine wheel, that's often when we what's called soul retrieval. I kind of call it life essence retrieval, really, rather than soul retrieval, because we always have our souls.
Yeah.
Tracy Chapman, all that we have is our soul.
Yeah.
But it's like some of our life essence, part of the soul, has sort of fled almost into hiding. Mm. So we can journey into the subconscious, the unknown, the inner depths, and retrieve this little life essence, this little part of us that's been held in grace. It might have fled due to trauma, it might, you know, experience. You're just retrieving it and just bringing it back and more as part of your energy field, more conscious part of your energy field.
It's a major part of the traditional shaman's job, isn't it? The retrieving of bits of people that have been left where the person isn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. there, but it's not. It's like deep, very deep in the.
Mm. Yeah. And that, so we must have got our way around to the east.
Yeah, the east. Ah, east. That's the place of the eagle, the energetic. Yeah. That's where we can really be aware of, you know, how everything is energy. It's where we start to come into the feeling. You know, you can hear people saying it, how we're source manifesting as ourselves, how we are in ourselves a source, but it's the feeling it, the being with it, that being with that, the energetic, how everything's energy, how, you know, this grass is just made up of lots of atoms, which is just energy.
Yeah.
When I say just, energy is awesome, but so it's just viewing the world from the energetic. It's also seeing the world from the biggest perspective in the calling the directions and in the medicine wheel. So we do seeing the world from bigger perspectives. And again, if you rise above your situation to see it from the bigger picture, it just, your whole journey looks different, you know.
And the eagle, of course, can see the whole picture from the zenith up there, but it can see all the detail too.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So it's just a really valuable way of, you know, of shifting things and holding things. And again, you can get caught up down here in it, but when you just step outside, you just suddenly just see the big picture, which makes more sense. And again, you can see your journey more clearly. And you can also see the little detail. You can see what the little detail means to you. And we ask you, you know, can we share your gift of flight, of sight, of seeing this world in new perspectives, you know, to be able to fly.
Brilliant.
And also we say, oh, maybe fly wing to wing with you, and great spirit, great creator, to the places we now dare to dream of. So it's also about actually achieving, you know, your journey, achieving your goals, and, you know, something that maybe you might think, oh, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't live that way, that's not possible. It's like, oh, actually, I do dare to dream that is possible. And even what I found when I did the directions, I went round to the east, not only did I find that it was not only possible, the things that I would have chosen if I had an ideal world, some of the bits of the ideal world, that other people were already living that way and have been doing so for 35 years or more. It's like, what? How did I not find out about it before? So it's really the place of transformation and self-transcendence sometimes, and of beginning to step from the healing journey to the envisionary journey, starting to realise that more is possible. And if all is potentially possible, what are we choosing to create? What do we want to participate in? So, the eagle's room.
Yeah. Are they associated with the elements as well, those four directions?
I expect so, although I haven't got round to translating them yet. Mm. You know what I mean? I think they'll translate, but I haven't sat down and gone, right, okay, that will, you know. You know, I serpent, earth makes sense to me. And I could probably just guess now.
Yeah.
But I've often thought, like, oh, I'm going to do that one day, and I haven't sat down and meditated.
And we do three more directions as well, don't we? Earth first, is it down?
Yeah, the receptive principle.
Yeah.
That holds us. And it just holds us with that unconditional love. You know, it just holds and it gives us abundance. And it's just asking the earth, you know, may you help hold us in sacred space, this wonderful, holding space that holds us each day, and also giving thanks for the holding.
Yeah.
And our connecting to the earth, it's also, like you said, the connecting with the earth in us and our connection with the earth.
It's a beautiful place to be held, isn't it, because we're surrounded by oak trees and the healing area is kind of held in the kind of bow of a stream. All this background stuff will be audible, which would be great, all the birds and the singing and the stream. So they can actually hear all of that going on. And then we do the sky.
Do the sky, the cosmos, the universe, the sky that also holds us. It holds us in the cosmic order of all things, you know. The earth holds us on the earth, and then well, above the sky, the universe, the, you know, the sun holds us in its orbit.
Yeah.
And so it's connecting with that. It's also the dynamic principle, the moving, the energy. And it's, also our connection as well to the stars. And I say like you're our brothers, sisters, ancestors and of the stars because, you know, to quote Moby, we are made of stars.
I
you know,
love
just
that.
The stardust, yeah. the stardust, you know. And to remember, you know, our history is in the earth, our bodies have come from the earth. But also our bodies and the earth have also come from the stars and the universe. And it's that connection that.
Because we're basically made of carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and only a few other things in lots of traces, but all of those basic elements are made in first generation stars and ride towards us apparently on the edge of plasma from the sun. These simple elements are created on the edge of plasma and arrive on the earth from the sun. And I love that idea of the mind of light beyond the sun, that are similar energies coming to the sun from the heart of the galaxy.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So interlinked, and we have that connection, right? And it's a reminder of that connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we ask for that cloak of protection as well, and share with that wisdom of infinities, and
we are the Big Bang happening. We're not dependent on it; we are it.
Well, I guess so, yeah. It's amazing that we kept our history, like we talk about the physical history now, has come from that Big Bang. Like we were, our physically, in a way, we were, you know.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah, yeah, and we're just the latest part of a process. You know?
riding
the Big Bang, which takes us to the last direction, which is the heart, isn't it?
I put my hand to the heart.
Yeah, inside.
Well, it's connecting to the divine, the creator, clearly the what some people call God, and there's loads of names, like I hear Kieran say, you know. You are known by so many names, whatever name you call that life energy, that creating energy, the one that created even the Big Bang, perhaps.
Yeah.
The one that feeds us, the ones that connect to us, and, you know, possibly the ones that are us, you know, if experience serves. So it's connected, it's inviting in that creator, that source spirit to hold us in sacred space, and of course, you know, hold us anyway, I'm finding, but to hold us in that sacred space and connecting with that source, that creative energy.
Can we just in closing talk a little bit about the ceremony that we did to dedicate the healing yurt, the little package that you made.
Oh, the dispatcho.
Yeah, just a little description of what the dispatcho is, and just a couple of minutes, chat, and then we can go and get something to eat and drink.
But,
I can listen to many things at once. That's part of the interviewing thing. It is apparently to be able to.
Speaking.
Nope.
There
you go. Must be my intuition.
Yeah, I think so. But
we've only got just a couple more minutes or so, and then we can move on.
So the dispatcho. In Peru, they use dispatchos quite a lot, apparently, for many things, and there's many different types of dispatchos. And it's a way of bringing the South into Aini with nature, with our lives around us. It could be a way of giving thanks for what's brought us together, thanks for the earth, thanks for all the gifts that we receive in living this life. And it can also be setting intention of what we want to bring in. It's working at the energetic, at the soul olympic level, it's working at the mind, and it's working at the physical together. So bringing all of those in Aini. Because at the energetic, we're blowing in what certain physical things mean to us. So I'm just trying to remember what people blew in.
I remember somebody, there was a dog rose, wasn't there?
Mm.
And so somebody said that the rose is a symbol of love. And I remember that the dog is kind of loyalty and faith, good faith from the beginning of time to the end of time.
Mm. So it's taking something like that, and you can take the traditional view of what it means, or you can just what it means to you at that moment, and just blowing that in and bring it in. So if you want to bring in acceptance, if you want to bring in love, I'll give thanks for love. You blow that in, so that's energetically blowing that energy in, and then you physically putting it in this a piece of paper, which eventually becomes get wrapped up like a parcel, like a gift. So you do that, and there's lots of different kinds. The one that I did was working with the different elements. So working with the earth, and we were giving thanks and for the earth and what we wanted to bring in for the festival that was connected with the earth, maybe being held by the earth, and giving thanks for the abundance the earth gives us. And then we did a layer of water, and there was wishes for to be free flowing like water is, and the thanks for the water that, you know, that gives us so much life. And then we did the fire and the warmth of the sun, thanks, and also from the warmth of my heart, they wanted to bring in and there's different objects, you know, different leaves or flowers, all natural berries, yeah, and fruits. But and you know, there are prescriptions, you know, this means this, that's meant that. But the way I like to work, I like to say, what does this mean to you? And blow that in. And the things that people come up with and say, it's like, yes, I agree with that. And yes, I'd like to bring that in too, you know. Mm. And I think that's lovely, the way they share that. So we had fire, and then we had air, that's right. So we had air and brought in things through the air, and yeah, the appreciation of the air we breathe, and yeah, wish to clean air, and
inspiration,
yeah, cause, yeah. And it's amazing, these things that are blown in, they can be very practical and down to earth, and then they can be completely spiritual, these wonderful things that are brought in. And and then also of creator spirits, that as well. That was blown in, that connection to the divine, and the wish to bring that. And some were connected, like the wish to be connected with the divine or creator, whatever name you want to give, but also the connection with the earth, and to have that balance. And and again, with dispatchos, you can get given specific lists of what to put in, but I quickly learned early on that it's good to work, I find it, for me. Well, you can go to Peru and buy like spatial kits, and that's great if you like to do that. But I like to work with what's around me, go with what's natural, and have a look and gather. I brought some sage from home, and I did actually use the traditional what that means wisdom when I blew it in. But then other people found other things to represent it. But yeah, I like working with what's around me and finding what I feel would be good.
It did make a very beautiful little layout before we folded it up with, because we had the dog rose leaves, and we had some sticks, and we had some old man's beard type light feathery seed, and there was golden marigolds, buttercups, I think they were in there, and some berries, presumably from the ivy. I don't know where they came from.
They were blueberries from what I brought with me.
Oh, they were imported, right, I was wondering. Yeah, yeah. I thought you were, maybe you were extremely canny wild food.
Yeah.
Well, that's been really nice, that has, because I think we've probably had a half hour.
Yeah,
and that'll be really, that's a really great chat, thank you very much. I'm glad we got it together. And like I say, I really enjoyed the ceremonies. I really did. I thought they were beautiful.
Aww,
and, you know, part of what's really been, I can only describe this whole weekend as a genuinely sublime experience.
it's been a real pleasure.
It has. Well, so hopefully we'll meet again.
I hope so. I want to ask you more questions.
Well, perhaps we swap email addresses before we part, because then we can, it'd be great.
Yeah.
We'll make sure we see each other again.
Yeah, that'd be great, because I've got lots to ask you.
This is Media Stream International Radio.
In the thick golden gloom of autumn, the dying light all your friends and your family. dream past me as I headed to the grave where you lay. The thud of the tumbling rocks left me breathless. Of a chalk hill and it lifted your pain away. I don't know how to feel this. I'm not sure there's a
Kidnap Alice with Chalk Hill Blue from their new EP, a song about a funeral of a friend of theirs, and what a line. We come in, we get going, and then we're gone. A really beautiful tune. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to play the song that I really wanted to play off that EP because it's got a question mark in it, in the title, which means that it plays fine in Linux, but it won't be, it won't play in Microsoft. So we'll have to save that one for next week as well. And before Kidnap Alice, a chat with Katie about ceremony with the sounds of children in the background and the sounds of a summer stream and birdsong in the trees above us. And some very important points there. I've noticed whilst doing my own education, or whatever we want to call this word, just gathering my own experience about these subtle and energetic realms in which we undoubtedly live. And by spending my time with people from the West who've had shamanic training, and also spending my time with Mayan shamans who've done the full thing, you know, the standing in a river up to their nose for 24 hours to find out what it's like being river and being buried naked in the desert to tell your story to the desert so that it goes away over the period of a day. That these messages, these ideas are all not only common across the world, apart from to our extraordinarily materialistic and mendacious society, they're not only applicable throughout the world and viewable, if you like, in these many different contexts. They also do work for us. If we become aware of them, they are really helpful ideas. As I keep saying, there's not a lot we can do about transforming other people. The only real gift we've got to give the world is our own transformation, and through that we will transform others. And it is these ideas, the ideas that Katie was talking about, that enable us to do that, because they're ideas that are recognisable within. When you can find yourself in a quiet or beautiful space and start thinking about these things, you do find that they are, in some sense, applicable. One of the things we talked about was the habit we have in this society. I think it's less so in the case in your shamanic and native societies, as we might call them, is that we embed experiences that we don't necessarily want in our own lives. And we do that by simply repeating the same disadvantageous story to ourselves again and again until we believe that disadvantage is the only thing we can get. We don't only repeat these stories to ourselves, we repeat them to others. And sometimes, as many of us as our memories are going, we can repeat them to the same person several times. And so they're being embedded in our environment, in our outer environment, as well as within ourselves. And I remember when I was speaking with Claire Montanaro about the issue of ego and just exactly what it is. I think it was Claire that suggested to me that we are an electrochemical flow. As we have experiences in the outside world, be they frightening or pleasurable or threatening or anything, that it is our hindbrain, our newt or reptile brain, that basically manages our feelings through the release of hormones at the base of the skull. And that this should be simply that, simply a chemical flow, just like the river, just like the stream was flowing by that interview. But as Katie says, if you imagine that the stream gets dammed, then the water kind of piles up around it, the shape of it changes, it becomes bigger. And the same is true of these chemical flows. If rather than letting the experience run by us and sitting down, normally just for 4 or 5 minutes, waiting for those chemicals to go away and see what the aftermath's going to be, if instead of doing that, we embed the response of fear or whatever it is, then it stays with us. And that is apparently what builds our ego, is holding on to things that are the us, if you like, from past moments, from past days, maybe from past lives, rather than just feeling the experience as it was and letting it move on. And the Buddhists would have us believe, and I tend to agree with them, that embedding joy and pleasure is no more advantageous than embedding fear and doubt. That really it is a matter of experiencing the moment, letting it flow by you, and see what the next moment brings. This can save us a lot of trouble, and I suspect is a subject that will come up a few times in this show. Part of that is a recognition of what we need, a recognition of recent experience, past experience, recognition of whatever it is we've been doing. Might have been a job that we had for a while, might have been a band that we've just seen, might have been a person, an individual that we've met and spoken to, heart to heart. Sometimes those are wholly positive experiences. I had many, many chats with just, really, a vast variety of really beautiful people over this weekend. It's not always like that, though. Quite often we have conversations with people that contain within them things that are useful and things that are not. And it's up to us to recognise what we need and to take that to our heart and, if you like, put it in our bundle to carry with us for future reference and recognise what we don't need that came from the conversation or whatever the experience was and to release it again as the stream. Just let it carry itself away. And part of the result of that is that the attempt to do that results in careful listening. The art of communication is not simply governed by the throat chakra, it's also governed by the ears. In fact, it is said by some that the most important part of speaking is the listening. And if we do this kind of recognition of what we need and what is useful and the release of what it isn't, what isn't, within ourselves, then it prevents us. It prevents us from, if you like, polluting our environment, polluting the people around us with wrong thinking or unuseful ideas. And from that stems my recent practice of only saying what is useful. And if, having looked at what I thought I might say, I don't have anything useful to say, then I will tend to say nothing. That has been one of my most powerful lessons in the last 2 or 3 years, is that sometimes, in fact most times, it has to be said, especially when there's any doubt at all, saying nothing is the best option. Partly because, as I say, it prevents you causing dis-ease to others around you. But also because it saves a lot of energy, and because most miraculously, in my opinion, when we choose not to add our 10 penneth, we can watch the thing that's going on in front of us. And I'm not joking, most of the time it resolves itself most beautifully without us sticking our oar in. Probably, again in my experience, a lot more beautifully than it would if I did stick my oar in. So part of that is avoiding telling and retelling an old story. Simply have it as it is. As Katie said, it's always there for us if we need it. We can go back in our memory. There's various ways of reaccessing it. We don't have to say it again and again and again to ourselves or to others. We can release our energetic ties to the past. And it's not only the stories we tell ourselves, but the stories that are retold to us, either from our DNA, from our inside, or from our outside, from our parents, from our grandparents, from teachers, from priests, and especially, of course, from Babylon Broadcasting, which specializes in maintaining at the front of our minds the disadvantageous flow of history as it is presented to us. But it is, of course, not only useless and disadvantageous patterns that are passed down to us. We are what we are because of the things our ancestors did, because of the ideas they had, because of the challenges they faced, and because of the responses they came up to them. And we are now the holders of that responsibility. Part of that, I love to chat about the hummingbird. I wasn't familiar with these particular creatures in association with the directions. My knowledge of the directions is quite different, but at the same time the same. But I love this idea that the hummingbird is a tiny little bird that flies thousands and thousands and thousands of miles. It doesn't know really in itself where it's going or what it's going to find at the end. It just goes in trust that it's going to find itself hovering in front of a particularly beautiful flower that will be full of what it needs. It is going where it knows not. And we're in fact doing just that. We are led to believe that what we have is some kind of security. And in fact, our habitual ways tend to encourage this idea in ourselves. But really, when we look at it, none of us know what we're going to do next. None of us know what others are going to do around us. And really, tomorrow is always a new dawn. It's always a new day. And I think that the world itself, I don't know what you lot feel out there, but it used to be, I think, a lot easier to plan for tomorrow, to imagine what we might do, and to have it turn out exactly as that. Perhaps it's because of the life I've chosen, a wander in the nations, and without a home address and all of that. Perhaps it's because of that, unless I feel more ready to just simply go where I will, and to respond as productively and creatively to whatever comes about as a result of that. Katie described that as the hero's journey. And as I mentioned, Joseph Campbell, a man about whom I will eventually do a show because he is so full of wisdom beyond that follow your bliss advice. He wrote a book called Hero with a Thousand Faces, meaning just that. There is only one story and it's our story. We are the authors of our own potential, which needs to be recognized. And from then you generate an opportunity to go with the heart. It is very scary. Abandoning a bank account, abandoning a stone address, abandoning a regular job, all sorts of things that are become embedded for cultural as well as personal reasons. It's very scary to leave these things, but the more often I've left them, the more effective in my experience it's become. And that advice to follow your bliss, follow your heart rather than your head, although it seems most unlikely, it is something that has unfailingly in my experience paid dividends. Following my head has sometimes got me a bit of a bruising, sometimes a bit of a kicking, and sometimes it's just caused so much disadvantage that I really ended up wondering why it was that I'd done it. And those are the years of experience that I've got. We've all got them. It is true perhaps that the older we get, the more experience we've got, but it's also true that the experience of children who are closer to source is also valid. And that they are, to as much as learning things in those early years, they're forgetting stuff that might be useful to them later, though it can be brought back. And those years of experience, I think, are one of the things that really paid off at the Fire in the Mountain Festival for me. It has been a long time since I've stayed up all night, especially without any kind of chemical aid, as it were. I'm a man who really likes my sleep nowadays. And I find myself getting very dozy even around 10 o'clock. But at the Fire in the Mountain on the Friday night, there was just hours and hours of chatting. It seemed to me that none of it was wasteful, that all of the conversation I had were progressive and useful and meaningful to myself and to my various interlocutors. We had a cracking time. It was, in all cases, a matter of a sympathetic ear coupled with a creative voice. And at some stage, I looked up from my latest pint of beer in the bar and it had got light outside and the birds were singing. It had somehow worked its way around to something like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I hadn't even noticed. I had been just so well entertained with good company that my inner me was responding and fizzing. And I know that Friday night, it was that case for many other people as well. There were lots of people who were awake all night then, experiencing pretty much what I did, I think. But experience isn't necessary to the awakening to this sort of stuff. It seems to me that the world is moving that direction anyway. I've spoken before about the fact that there are people out there who are just suddenly awakening to the true nature of the world in which they find themselves. They are just suddenly, without previously seeking or having a religious or spiritual background or any of these things, without meditating, without perhaps having any idea beyond articulated lorries and Ginster's pasties and chips of what life is about, and they are suddenly, just suddenly, becoming aware in the blink of an eye that they are the cosmic background and that they are not simply an object floating in space. And as Katie said, there's many, many people coming to this just by themselves now. Again, as I think I've said before, probably many times, these awakenings quite often come as a result of our experiences of the true nature of the community in which we find ourselves. Many of the things that are spoken about at Truth Juice talks and the rest, experiences with it might be with vaccines, it might be being rolled over by the courts, it might be being robbed by the bank or the bailiffs. But these things are experiences in the physical administrative world, and when they knock themselves home, many, many of us find ourselves straight away on some kind of spiritual path. So this awakening is now occurring with or without experience, or with whatever experience it is that people have. And what it seems to be doing to them, to me, is it is enabling them to abandon the old stories that they've taken on and to allow for themselves a news story. To a certain extent, there is very little choice, of course. Most of us, when we fall down the rabbit hole, we've done so because our butts are against the wall. But it doesn't matter to me whether we're forced to allow the news story or whether we choose to take it on. It is the taking on of the story that's important. It is the recognition that we are all, every single one of us, on a hero's journey, that we are all the authors of our own stories and our own destinies. And the sooner we pick up the blue pen and start writing it for ourselves and trying to prevent other people from writing it for us, then the better. Soul retrieval, past life retrieval, whatever it is you want to call it. She said that, you know, there is some evidence of reincarnation and the rest, which I tend to agree. It's one of those things that the more you look at it, the more real it appears to be. But I was never sure of it when I started reading shamanic works all that time ago. I was never sure just exactly what this was. But as is the way with things, eventually you come across specific examples that take these ancient cultural ideas and put them into a context which is understandable. And I remember listening to the fabulous Freeman Jack talking about the nature of some tortured childhoods that he had experienced or heard tell of. And I've come across it again since listening to those podcasts, that many times what happens to individuals when they have a particularly difficult time as youngsters, when their emotional bodies are subjected to experiences which they are unable to withstand, then a little bit of the personality gets buried somewhere in the back of the mind and more or less ignored. It's always there, and it's always muttering and shouting, but it is buried. It's hidden away, because the individual can no longer afford to look at that. The only way they can move on is to, if you like, excise a wee bit of what's happened to them and somehow move on from there and leave it for dealing with later. And talking with Katie a bit more and with one or two other people at the festival, I realised that there's links. It may even be the same thing between this sort of shamanic tendency. It's one of the big jobs of your shamans to go and retrieve and recognise the bits of individuals that have somehow been left behind, like the shale on the side of a river, and to help the people tidy it up. So they do it using shamanic and energetic techniques. There are other ways of doing it in our society, which we call therapy and various other things. Any of it works, but it is important to recognise that there may be some things that we need to look at and to shake out a little in front of ourselves, because we can't let go of them if we're not acknowledging that they're there. And the idea of the eagle in these shamanic cultures, these ancient cultures, is very much to do with that. The eagle by the mire is associated with the zenith sun, the sun as it stands at midday up there in those parts of the world, really directly overhead in the sky. So that if it's shining over a stella or a stone or a pyramid, that no shadow will be cast for a short while at the middle of the day. And it is said that the eagle's advantage is to be able to see from its huge height the whole picture, to be able to see a massive portion of the earth below it. But it also has the sharpest of eyes, which enable it to see even the tiniest of creatures moving within that big picture. So both things are important. We get so much buried in the detail that we don't have time to look at the context within which the detail exists. The ability to stand back from situations that are giving us either pleasure or pain and see the whole thing is extremely useful. I think the representative of the eagle at the festival was the red kite, something that is now very common throughout Wales. It was reintroduced successfully, and it is a truly astonishing bird. Normally, we get to see it hovering or flying really pretty high in the sky, but round and about the farm where the fire in the mountain was happening, these creatures were sometimes just 10 or 12 feet above our heads, flying silently over the top of us, looking at us. And they've got, at full growth, they've got a 6-foot wingspan. These things are really big and beautiful birds, and they're actually highly reminiscent of these Native American cultures and the eagle. Katie's idea that so often we cage ourselves in by believing that we can't, there are certain types of life, certain ways of living that are not open to us, that are not possible for us. But by aspiring to them by thinking about them, and by perhaps following a little bit the kind of hints that come at us from the environment, we're quite often led to people who have in fact been doing exactly what we've been dreaming of for, she said, 35 years. So obviously she's had a specific experience, but I agree with her. I keep coming across people who are doing things that I might have considered doing 20, 30 years ago, but I didn't meet the right people. I was believing the story that I was being told. I did believe, in fact, in those days that that I really couldn't, if you like, exist or survive usefully outside a factory, because I'd spent so long in one being so useful that there was a bit of me, quite a large chunk of me, that believed that I couldn't usefully do anything else. It would become quite a paradox, I think, to many of you by now, that I've learned that there are many, many useful things that we can all do. And part of it is seeing others live the life that we believe to be impossible for ourselves. Many times, recognizing other people's experience is as important as having experiences ourselves. In fact, maybe that's why we're all there. Maybe it's because there's too much to experience, too much to remember, too much to believe. And as Alan Watts said in one of the podcasts we were playing on the Dr. Rock Show a few weeks back, he was saying that one of the reasons that other people are there is because we wouldn't know what we think unless we hear what others think around us. It is, in that sense, an entirely relative existence. We talked about the additional directions, because these native peoples don't only do north, south, east and west. To them, that is, if you like, the two-dimensional field upon which we play as entities living in this dense matter world. To them, it's not, the world doesn't become three-dimensional until you take up and down into account. And it is the meeting of those two basic principles that make the living in north, south, east and west possible. So the first place we look, or if you like, the fifth place we look in that ceremony, is down. We look down, we touch the earth, and we feel it. And that is embodying the receptive principle. It is the earth from which, as far as we're concerned, at least, all matter stems. And the word matter and mater, the Roman word for mother, are related to each other. So the energetic construing of matter is what the earth is about. But the energy comes from the creative principle for which we look up and outwards. We look up to the cosmos. And we realize, of course, do we not, that all of the energy that we need to survive comes to us from the sun. That trees form 80% of their complex carbohydrates directly in the leaves as a result of sunshine, and they transfer it down from there to their roots. And it is this energetic interaction between pattern or energy or pater, the word for father in Latin, and the mother or matter and the earth. It is the mixing together of those two things with the energetic spirit that moves within us. Whatever it is that moves into our self at the moment of conception. So we have the passive, the receptive, or the receptive, the energetic, and then the thing that fires it all up in the middle. The dispaccio, the second ceremony that she was talking about, it looked really beautiful. By the time we'd finished working our way through these little bundles of sticks and seeds and golden flowers and all the rest of it, what we had was a little layout on a piece of paper, a bit of A3 paper, which had within it energetically all of the hopes and aspirations and all of the love and the heart and all of the thought that had gone into that wee ceremony, all lying there represented on a single piece of paper. And the paper was then folded up to include and house all of those things and all of those feelings for us. And we then wrapped it in the rather beautiful piece of cloth that can be seen in the slideshow sitting in the middle of those white stones in the healing area. But before we put it out there, we used this package to, it's called smudging, is the way the native tradition has been translated. In the old English tradition, it was called saining. And it is normally done with incense or a sage stick or something. And the idea is that you blow the smoke, in the case of incense and the sage stick, over and around the bodies and the energetic bodies of the people that are partaking in the ceremony. quite often concentrating particularly on the hands and the feet, but making sure you move down through all of the energy centers. And at the end of this particular ceremony, we actually use the dispatchio. So we use this little package with all of these things in it to physically, for each one of us, to cleanse the aura and the energetic space of the person that was standing next to them. Itself a beautiful experience and a great way of saning a person. And at the end of the festival, the very end of the festival, one of the last things that we did was to, in our closing ceremony, was to take the dispatchio and take the flowers from within that circle of quartz crystal stones and to give it to the water, and it just bobbed away. So that was a really beautiful start to the festival, I thought. I'm going to play another tune now, just by way of a bit of a break from the voice. And this time, before we go back perhaps to the, before we go back to a little bit more of the slideshow, this time, this is the only, I'm going to play three or four tracks by these guys. They're called Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra. And they weren't actually at the Fire in the Mountain Festival, so they've only got, technically speaking, I guess they haven't really got a place here, but I'd really love to see them at the festival next year. A bit later on, we'll hear about one of the venues that was at the Fire in the Mountain, run by a man called Al. He runs a thing called Al's World, which is one of our favourite places. Got to see some of the most intense audience experiences definitely happened in that beautiful enclosed tent of a space. But one of the things that Alan does is what he describes Al's World as purveyors of fine quality entertainment, and they organise tours and public address systems and all of the services that go with that. And at the very end of the fest, I was talking to him and he was telling me that he was going on tour. He was organising a tour, helping him out with Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra. I'll be coming up with a few details and a website for them later. But they're every single song on their album, which is called Money Isn't Everything, is worth listening to. And this is the title track. It's called Money Isn't Everything. And I'm absolutely certain you're going to love the tone and the tune, and the lyrics especially are really cracking. So here they go. Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra playing Money Isn't Everything. And although they weren't at the Fire in the Mountain Festival, Al was, and that's good enough for me.
Money isn't everything. It doesn't make the world go round. Money doesn't grow on trees. The nickel, the dollar, the penny, the pound. Money makes a good man bad. It makes a sweet turn sour. Money can't buy me love. Money is power. Thank you. He keeps slipping through my fingers, leading me astray, out of the front door, into the bar. You keep jumping out my pocket, I don't know how to stop it. You and me, we won't get far. Money isn't everything, it doesn't make the world go round. Money doesn't grow on trees, the nickel, the dollar, the penny, the pound. Money makes you feel mad, bad, makes the sweet turn sour. Money can buy me love, money is power. Quit you, baby, leave you today. Gonna run away to a land where they don't need you anyway. I'm gonna quit you, baby, leave you today. Gonna run away to a land where they don't need you anyway. You keep slipping through my fingers, leading me astray. Out of the front door, into the bar. You keep jumping out my pocket, I don't have to stop it. You and me, we won't get far. Money isn't everything, it doesn't make the world go round. Money doesn't grow on trees, the nickel, the dollar, the penny, the pound. Money makes a good man bad, makes sweet and sour. Money can't buy me love, money is power.